10 lives have been lost, and more families have been shattered by gun violence in the state of Colorado. And Jill and I are devastated. And the feeling, I just can't imagine how the families are feeling, the victims whose futures were stolen from them, from their families, from their loved ones.
President Joe Biden speaking at the White House today about the 10 victims of a mass shooting in Boulder yesterday. Colorado has a long history of high-profile mass shootings. Columbine in 1999, the Aurora movie theater in 2012, and now the King Soopers grocery store in Boulder. An analysis by the Denver Post 2 years ago found that Colorado has more mass shootings per capita than all but 4 states. We're going to talk about that now with Susan Payne, former local and state police officer in Colorado, who founded the state's Safe to Tell program after Columbine. It's an anonymous mental health and safety reporting system. She's also a research associate with the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado Boulder. Welcome to Press Play, Susan.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry for the circumstances.
I am very, very sorry for the circumstances. What do you make of what happened in Boulder yesterday? You've worked for a long time in this area.
Well, I think right now what we're experiencing and what the president just said is, you know, heartbreak and loss and tragedy, certainly trauma, but also, you know, anger and frustration about what can we do to stop these things before they happen. And how do we invest in preparing as if it will happen here?
Right. And so there's a sense of inevitability that these things will continue to happen. In Colorado in particular, why does there appear to be more mass shootings in your state than in most other states?
You know, I think that's a really good question. And you know, my 30 years of law enforcement, I would say I never went into it expecting to respond to this many mass shootings. But I would also say that this is really a national issue. There are no jurisdictional boundaries to mass acts of violence, whether it's Las Vegas or most recently Atlanta. We are seeing it across our nation. There is a strong investment in response, but how we can work towards prevention is really a passion of mine. And I think the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence.
Well, so what is the answer? I mean, all of us want to prevent these things from happening again, but we have different perspectives. On the one side, there's gun control, and on the other side, there is addressing, I guess, mental health issues involving potential shooters or no gun control. Where do you fall on this? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I mean, we've had that conversation, you know, same song, different verse throughout history. I mean, we've seen things in 1994 with the Crime Bill Act. Obviously, after Sandy Hook, this conversation has taken place. But no matter what we do in that conversation, we have to prepare as if there are guns both legally and illegally available. And how we identify those that are exhibiting concerning behavior or are broadcasting in advance of a tragedy like this, and what's the infrastructure to prevent it? I think that that's really one of the gaps that is part of the solution, is building an infrastructure of prevention moving forward.
Why hasn't that infrastructure been built already? I mean, this has been going on for a very, very long time. The shootings in Columbine happened in the 90s. So why haven't we been able to really enact effective prevention strategies?
You know, I think we have to really invest in the communication surrounding what can be done, what we know through research will work, what are best practices, how have we done it in schools? Takes us back all to more than 20 years ago with the Columbine tragedy and seeing the changes in response, prevention, target hardening, all of the things that have been done. But community safety is a priority. And how do we invest in those things? Because you can't do it without resources and capacity increases.
So 3 years ago, the city of Boulder banned assault weapons in response to the Parkland shooting. And just, I believe, on Friday, a judge threw that ban out, saying that state law basically doesn't allow cities to enact their own gun control legislation. Do you think that was a mistake?
You know, I think that goes to the state level to make those decisions is what they overturned on that. But even if that's been in place, here is a killer that came in from a county outside of Boulder and entered a grocery store in Boulder. And so a local, I don't know what difference when you look at, would that have prevented this? No, I don't see that as a prevention.
Right. Well, what about Colorado has this so-called red flag law. Police can confiscate guns from people who've threatened to harm themselves or other people. The shooter's siblings have described him as a deeply disturbed individual. So I guess there'll be some investigation as to why the red flag law wasn't used. But I'm wondering if your organization would be a place where people could turn to if they suspect someone might carry out a violent act like this.
So what you're describing is so important. That's a great question, because if there were siblings or neighbors or others that saw the warning signs, saw the concerning behavior, where would they report it is my question. How do we build an infrastructure like we've done for schools where you can report it, where you know that someone will take action and that they will intervene and are trained in assessing the threat, determining if there's a grievance, determining if they do have weapons? How do we invest in that level of prevention? And I think that would be, if I had a magic wand, what we as researchers would want to see happen.
Mm-hmm. Would they be able to call Safe to Tell, your organization, if they suspected that?
Safe to Tell, what we learned in mass attacks across schools is that long before adults, young people knew what was taking place or what was going on, and we needed to remove the barriers to early reporting. That is a school-based focused initiative, similar to what we've done on, just targeting. When you look at a school being a soft target, how do we increase the defensibility of the safety of a school? So that continues to be a work in progress. Moving that into a community strategy would be something that we would include in building an infrastructure of prevention nationally. Of what are those best practices that should be incorporated into community safety as well as school safety?
What about Colorado's political culture? A member of Congress, she's a freshman, Lauren Boebert, very vocal about her pro-gun stance. She even does video interviews with a bunch of rifles in the background. What kind of climate politically does your state perhaps contribute to a feeling that gun violence is pervasive and that there doesn't need to be a crackdown on guns?
I would say it goes on both sides of the fence. The debate about gun violence has been occurring for more than 20 years in this country. It's usually a target of conversation immediately following a mass attack, and that's sometimes why we can't get to the strategies of best practices and prevention. I think it's a debate that's going to continue moving forward. I don't know that I don't think there's been enough research done on that, on how effective that's been or how we would move forward with identifying the effectiveness of laws like that. I think that there's work to be done in that research.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Susan Payne from the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at University of Colorado at Boulder. Yet another problem with the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine. The company says its vaccine is 79% effective at preventing symptoms and 100% effective in preventing death. But in a highly unusual move, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases now says AstraZeneca's results may have been based on outdated information. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on Good Morning America this morning.
And this kind of thing does, as you say, do nothing but really cast some doubt about the vaccines and maybe contribute to the hesitancy. It was not necessary. If you look at it, the data really are quite good, but when they put it into the press release, it wasn't completely accurate.
AstraZeneca says it will release updated data within the next few days. It is not the first problem for the company and this vaccine. And here to talk about this is Sarah Overmall, healthcare reporter for Politico. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what is the nature of this dispute between the federal government and the company over its results?
Well, it really is highly unusual. And so this is also something that's happening really only during this pandemic, that vaccine makers are issuing their data, their results for their vaccines, through press releases. So it's not the typical process where you get something into a medical journal and we all look at the data at the same time. When they released that press release, according to Dr. Fauci and others, it took the National Institutes of Health by surprise, and specifically their Data Safety Monitoring Board, who said, that's not the latest data, and we know you have the latest data. We know now from a letter that they sent to AstraZeneca that Washington Post broke that the latest data actually suggests it's between 69% and 74% effective instead of 79%. So it's not even that far off, but it is different. And so it begs the question of why AstraZeneca went and did that. But they've been under a lot of pressure lately. There's been a lot of bad press. And so maybe this was an effort gone wrong to repair their image a little bit.
I guess, but it's only damaging their image further, right? I mean, as Dr. Fauci said, this is an unforced error.
Exactly. And also, like you said, this only puts more mileage into vaccine hesitancy camps, people who are already skeptical about vaccines in general, let alone coronavirus vaccines because of how quickly they've been developed. And what's sad about this is all indications are that the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe and effective. It's been used in 50 countries now. And health officials in the U.S. believe it still has a very important part to play, either in U.S. vaccinations or across the globe. But these things are overshadowing that.
Well, speaking of across the globe, this vaccine is being used in Europe, in Britain, in other places in the world. And what has been the review process in those places? Have they had similar problems with AstraZeneca?
Well, yes and no. The review process went a bit faster in those countries because they decided to take some of AstraZeneca's data from its other trials, from its UK trials, not necessarily at face value, but with what AstraZeneca had done in those ones, it had mistakenly half-dosed 3,000 people. So there's two shots. With the first shot, they accidentally only gave them half of the vaccine substance. And strangely, that showed better results. In the U.S., officials said, that's not going to fly with us. You either give us the results from the full dose regimen or from the half dose regimen. And so that's why it's taken long in the U.S. So that was one way that they diverged. But there absolutely have been issues in Europe. Some countries started to restrict if older people could be getting the vaccine, saying that there weren't enough older people in the trials. And then most recently, in these past few weeks, countries have brought up concerns with blood clots, and that led to 13 European countries and others in Africa and Asia suspending use of the vaccine, even though a lot of them have since picked it back up because the European Medicines Agency, sort of like the FDA for that region, did say they insisted this is safe and effective. But by that point, confidence has been dented. A lot of Europeans say that they don't trust this vaccine now, unfortunately.
Right. So the blood clot issue was quickly resolved. But what about the issue that you just mentioned, that the trial had some question because it was using healthy adults only? How did the company, why did the company do that? Who made that decision? And because clearly it seems like that would contravene normal scientific practice.
Right. I think it's hard to say why exactly they did it. They said that they just got a later start on enrolling older individuals and people with other health risks. But absolutely, you do want a vaccine trial to enroll as diverse a population as possible, whether it be age, whether it be health conditions, ethnicity, any factors, so that when you release it to the broader public, you're not going to get surprises. The good thing we have to say is that the AstraZeneca vaccine is being used in other countries now, and there aren't actually many causes for concern. The blood clot incidence has been shown to be the same as blood clot incidence without vaccines. So despite those countries acting to suspend it, the EMA and health officials in the U.S. believe that it's still safe. But they have said that they were working on getting more people enrolled. Now the issue for AstraZeneca isn't just getting a trial population that reflects the rest of the world, everyone who's going to be getting the vaccine, but also the variants of the coronavirus and how that has factored into their effectiveness.
Well, let's talk about the variants. In South Africa, I think they decided to sell off their supply of AstraZeneca vaccines this week because a small study found evidence that the vaccine offered hardly any protection against the South African variant. First of all, who bought these vaccines and what is South Africa going to do now in terms of vaccinating its public?
Other African countries bought those vaccines. I think it was roughly 1.5 million, and those were mostly bought by other countries on the continent. But in terms of what South Africa is going to do now, they are going to be in a really difficult position because the AstraZeneca vaccine has been billed as sort of the global vaccine. It's logistically easy to store and ship. It's cheaper than some of the other vaccines. And also AstraZeneca has partnerships worldwide to produce it. And so if a country like South Africa is going to say, we're not using this, which like you said, that has to do with the data showing that that variant there really does not respond as strongly as other ones. So it makes sense that they're saying that this is not the best option for us, but then it's a question of, well, who else is going to give you those options? And so from here in the U.S., Pfizer and Moderna haven't made many global agreements to supply their vaccine, Pfizer more than Moderna. Johnson & Johnson has made global agreements, and they're working on those, but they've already had manufacturing delays themselves. So then you get to things like the Chinese and Russian vaccines that haven't gone through the same World Health Organization studies and principles that some of these other ones have.
What's the likelihood the United States will approve the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine here?
It's going to be a difficult one, and I imagine that the advisory committee that FDA convenes is going to have a lot of difficult questions for them. I would get ready for a day of real debate. But the interesting and somewhat confusing thing as we find out more information about what AstraZeneca did is that their data are still good. They just messed up on releasing it, according to the way that DSMB has talked to them. If it is between 69% and 74% effective against broad disease and 100% effective against severe disease, that's more or less on par with Johnson & Johnson, and it still is going to have a useful role to play. The problem now becomes confidence. So I do think that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will authorize it. It's just a matter of how many Americans are going to use it and then what gets done with those 300 million doses that America has bought from AstraZeneca and who gets those.
Well, some of it is going to Mexico and Canada, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So 4 million of what we have in stock right now is going to Mexico and Canada. And there was a little bit of concern from people when that announcement was made. Not that it was intentional, but it was made right around the same time as all this blood clot concern in Europe. And some people were worried that there'd be this sort of unintentional message that we're unloading supplies of this vaccine now that we're set up with other ones and there are questions about it.
Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Overmall. She covers healthcare for Politico. Coming up, are we here in Southern California at risk from a tsunami? Seismologist Lucy Jones tells us next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Huge stretches of LA County's coastline could be at a big risk for a tsunami and all that damage and flooding. That's according to new maps released yesterday by the California Geological Survey. The areas at highest risk include Marina del Rey, Long Beach, Venice, Santa Monica, Malibu. Joining us to talk about this is Lucy Jones, seismologist and author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, good to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you. And what is the likelihood, really, of a tsunami hitting Southern California? I don't think any of us have really experienced one, or a big one at least.
Well, it's relatively low. A tsunami is a sudden rise in sea level caused by, usually by a big earthquake somewhere that changes the shape of the seafloor. So the biggest ones are local, and we have very little risk from that, relatively speaking, because our faults are mostly horizontal moving. So our local risk is much lower than a place like the Pacific Northwest or Japan or Chile or any of the places with subduction zones. We can have them coming in from elsewhere, and that's mostly what you're seeing mapped in these new maps. But it is a sudden rise in sea level. If you are 10, 20 feet above sea level, you're probably out of the danger zone. It'd be very difficult to get above 10 feet here. And, you know, plenty of our coastline is cliff. I mean, Malibu, the only thing at risk is really the beach, because you're above 20 feet very, very quickly. Venice and Long Beach and the marina are all places where it stays close to sea level for a greater distance inland. But even so, none of the expected tsunamis make it past Lincoln Boulevard.
Well, there's a lot of stuff between the beach and Lincoln Boulevard, though. I mean, a lot of houses and businesses and people.
Right. And but these are all, you know, our risk is primarily from distant tsunamis. As I said, we don't have the type of structures offshore that give it very often. So you're going to have a few hours. You know, you can walk from the marina across Lincoln from, you know, in 2 hours. As long as people who live in that area understand it and know that when they get a warning, they get out, the life loss is really minimal. And that's why it's so important that California's done this really great job. It's the California Geological Survey, of mapping out where it could be going, where we have the low-lying land, where we have offshore features that'll focus in some water. It's one of those things that for Southern California, it's a much lower risk than many of the other things we face.
Right. Earthquakes, fires, and those kinds of things.
Earthquakes, fires, and landslides and floods. You know, I mean, we had a huge flood in 1861-62 that put most of the L.A. Basin and most of Orange County underwater. It's more likely the water's going to come from our mountains than from the ocean on the long run.
Interesting. Right. But we all have this image of the Fukushima disaster in Japan several years ago and what happened there. You're saying that that is not likely at all to happen at any scale here.
In Southern California, I'm close to saying it's impossible. You know, quite a few years ago, when I was with the USGS, we did something that was called the Safer Tsunami Scenario. And we were working with the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and we were trying to find the worst possible tsunami that we could. The really worst possible is one that happens like, you know, every million years or 100,000 years or something, which would be a flank failure of the Hawaiian volcano. But we didn't do that because that's so, so unlikely. But once we took the sort of standard sources for tsunamis, we just couldn't get really big motions in Los Angeles. The closest subduction zone that's that heads towards us is Alaska, but it's coming from the north. So the fact that our coastline turns and runs more, you know, faces more south actually protects us from that. So it was sort of weird. We were like frustrated. We couldn't get a really big tsunami into Southern California.
Well, that's too bad.
Really, the rest of us are all grateful.
even if there was, let's say, a big one from coming from Alaska, we would still have hours of time to get out of the way. What about Northern California?
Okay, Northern California is at significantly more risk. The coastline faces more westerly, so really big earthquakes from like Japan and the Philippines can get in there. The Alaska one also causes significant impact. When we modeled this Alaskan tsunami, we basically took the Tohoku earthquake and put it in Alaska. And we got, I think it was 5 meters at Half Moon Bay. So we got a big wave coming in. But again, it's a very limited number of people who are at risk.
And I think the big thing I want to point out, and people can go see these maps, you're usually talking about a block or two in California. 77% of our coastline is cliff. And that means that sea level rise doesn't matter.
What if you're all those rich people on the Malibu beach there?
Well, the ones actually on the beach, yes. But most of them actually live up in the hills, right?
Yeah, but there are houses right on the beach there. David Geffen, for example.
Right. Those ones will go. But even there, I think we got in, as I said, we had 5 meters in Half Moon Bay and we had a meter and a half in Malibu because the coastline's facing south. I wouldn't stay in a house there, but it might survive.
And how much morning would you have if you were in one of those houses?
For an Alaska one, you'd have like 4 hours.
How are people warned about a tsunami? Is it a text message? Oh, what is it?
It comes from NOAA. It goes out through web sets. California Office of Emergency Services tries to rebroadcast it. My guess is it'll be out through every media that they can find, but I don't know of a system where you can sign up to get text messages, for instance, at least at this point. Up in Oregon, they're doing more of that. They have that subduction zone locally. So in Oregon, you could have an earthquake and produce a tsunami, a big tsunami coming in 15 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that. But that structure begins at Cape Mendocino. So northernmost California has that risk. I don't know if you noticed with the new maps out from the state of California, they updated Los Angeles, but then the three northern counties, Humboldt, Del Norte, and another northern county, and now I'm forgetting which one. And those are the ones that have the local tsunami risk. 12 people died in Crescent City, California, in the 1964 Alaskan earthquake from a tsunami that came in. They actually moved away from the bay. They saw the tsunami came in. After the wave went out, they went down to see what had happened, and a second wave came in. And as often true, the second wave was bigger than the first one.
Hmm. So all told, we should not be worrying too much about tsunamis here. We should be thinking about wildfires and earthquakes.
Yeah. I mean, don't ignore it. The one other thing is, if you feel strong shaking at the beach, leave the beach. Because with a local tsunami, you don't have very much time. We don't have the big sources, but an earthquake could be triggering a landslide, and that could cause a very local tsunami. I mean, the downside is you lose a day at the beach, and the upside could be your life.
That's a good trade-off.
Yeah.
Seismologist Lucy Jones, author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, a new British TV show takes place during the early years of the AIDS epidemic, revealing how little HIV or AIDS was talked about publicly at the time.
I remember really television being the only place where I learned about HIV and AIDS. It wasn't in school, it wasn't at home, it wasn't anywhere else, but it was coming home after school every afternoon and putting on the Phil Donahue show.
That's next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yes.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Yes, it's time for our weekly TV on the Radio segment. Streaming now on HBO Max, the show It's a Sin tells the story of young gay men in 1980s London, just as the HIV AIDS crisis comes to disrupt their lives. It is cast with actors who identify as members of the LGBTQ community. The show comes after decades of HIV and AIDS stories told on TV, many of which were problematic and not always made from the perspective of the communities affected by the virus. Joining us now to talk about this is Eric Piepenberg. He recently wrote an essay in the New York Times looking back at how TV has handled stories about HIV/AIDS. Welcome to Press Play, Eric.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You write in that essay that really TV is how you first learned about HIV/AIDS. What do you remember seeing on TV about that?
Yeah, I'm a Gen Xer, and I grew up in the 80s, and I watched a lot of television. It was on all the time. And as I write in the essay, I remember really television being the only place where I learned about HIV and AIDS. It wasn't in school, it wasn't at home, it wasn't anywhere else, but it was coming home after school every afternoon and putting on the Phil Donahue show. He was someone who kept it real, and I remember that there were conversations about HIV and AIDS on the Phil Donahue show. But I think the one memory that really stands out for me in terms of how television taught me about HIV and AIDS was seeing Rock Hudson and Doris Day at a press conference where it was announced that Rock Hudson was sick. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is not the dashing debonair actor from Pillow Talk. This is a man who looks very, very sick. And I thought, well, that's what it must mean to be gay then, is that you are going to get this disease. Because if it affected someone as famous as Rock Hudson, well, then I'm going to be next. But as I read in my essay, there was also this wonderful episode of Designing Women, which was a really funny sitcom. And in one of the episodes, there is a gay character who has AIDS. And to his defense comes Julia Sugarbaker, the great character portrayed by Dixie Carter, who verbally beats down one of her friends who says that AIDS is killing all the right people.
As far as I'm concerned, this disease has one thing going for it. It's killing all the right people.
Imogen, I'm terribly sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to move your car.
Why?
Because you're leaving.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the only thing worse than all these people who never had any morals before AIDS are all you holier-than-thou types who think you're exempt from getting it.
So there was a little bit of news that I remember, but also at least one show, a sitcom no less, that taught me what AIDS was, how it affected people, and that there were people out there who were going to stand up for people who were sick.
But how did you incorporate these messages that you received, especially the one that you received about Rock Hudson? How did you incorporate those messages into your own sexuality and coming of age and coming out? Like, did it affect you in terms of embracing your sexuality?
I would say in a complicated way that it did. At the time, I was deeply closeted. I was living in suburban Cleveland at the time at home with my parents. And I remember thinking, well, that's going to be me in a couple years. I hadn't fully embraced the fact that I was gay yet, but I saw Rock Hudson and I thought, well, that's what happens to gay men. And I very much internalized that message and just sort of prepared for that day to come. And it wasn't until I left Cleveland and moved to New York in 1989, when I saw that there was this gay world out there, that there were gay men who were thriving, and even though there were gay men who were sick, there were people who loved them and cared for them. So in a strange way, as awful as that message was that I received as this scared and deeply closeted teenager, it turns out that that was a message that showed me that there were gay men out there, and that if you did get sick, there were going to be people who cared for you. So in the end, I have to say that it was a message that helped me in some ways to come out and to accept who I was. But that is a message that in some ways has never really gone away because it made such an impression on me.
But I guess also, there weren't a lot of TV shows telling rich, detailed stories of gay life. I mean, I guess what you're talking about is a couple of mentions of AIDS. But if that's what gay life was, then I could see how you would get a distorted picture of what it meant to be gay. I mean, Where on TV did you go to learn about what it was like to have a full life as a gay man?
Yeah, I have to say, growing up in the 80s, I really didn't see that. I remember that there was the character of Steven on Dynasty, who was actually gay in the very first season, but it was very shameful. And then, you know, of course, I have memories of watching people like Paul Lynde and Charles Nelson Reilly and Liberace, who were gay, even though that they didn't say that they were gay, but they were still out there and they were campy and they were funny and people loved them. And, you know, when those are the only representations that you have, gay men are either secretive or closeted or dying, or they're just comedians that everyone laughs at. That's not a very healthy way to look at your sexuality in terms of seeing yourself reflected on television. It really wasn't until the 90s with shows like Tales from the City and Queer as Folk, which was the show created by Russell T. Davies, who also created It's a Sin. That's when I started to finally realize, oh, okay, being gay doesn't mean that you're going to die when you're very young. It doesn't mean that you're going to be shunned. There is a world out there, at least what television is showing me, that is a world where gay people are loved and accepted. And I wish I'd had that earlier.
Mm. And so you mentioned Russell T. Davies, who created Queer as Folk. And that's a great segue to talk about It's a Sin, which is out now on HBO Max. And let's just play a clip with the main character, Richie, talking with his boyfriend about their dreams to be in show business.
I want to be anyone. I want to be Hamlet. I want to be Romeo. But if I said I'm gay, I'd be just the clown.
So, what would you be if you could be in anything? If you ever get to be in anything?
Oh, funny. I just want to do good work. I don't mind. I'll have two lines as long as it's good.
So what do you make of the characters on this show? Can you describe them and what your reaction was to them?
Yeah, I think my reaction to them was very much looking in the mirror in a lot of ways. I mean, these are young gay men who come to the big city from smaller towns, which is very much my experience. And they move to the big city and they explore everything that gay London has to offer, from dating and sex and finding friendships and getting jobs. And that was very much my experience. Two, I think the biggest difference, and one of the reasons that I wanted to actually write this essay, was that I'm a little bit younger than these characters. In It's a Sin, it starts in 1981 and goes for another 10 years. And those are really the worst, the most devastating years of the AIDS crisis in London and New York, certainly. When I got to New York, I was 18 in 1989. And at that point, we already knew that AIDS was caused by a virus, and that virus was HIV, and that safer sex would protect you if you had sex. These characters didn't have that knowledge until later in the series. And, you know, it's no spoiler when you talk about shows about AIDS that it has devastating consequences for these characters. So while I see a lot of myself in being 18 and discovering and devouring everything that was in gay New York, I'm also grateful that I came of age a little bit later when I knew how to protect myself, and something that these characters just didn't have until it was too late.
So were you thinking, looking at these characters, like, that could have been me 10 years ago, and thank God I was born 10 years later?
Yeah, sorry. It's really sort of very emotional for me to talk about that, because I think if I didn't have the knowledge that I had, that might have been me. And I think one of the most affecting things about having written this piece is that I heard from other gay men who are older than me, of an older generation, who said thank you for this, because I was one of those guys who lived through the worst years, and I made it out on the other end. But as I was watching the show, I couldn't help but think, if I had just been born a little bit earlier, I'm not sure if I would have been able to write this piece.
Mm, wow. And it's, yeah, and it's interesting to see their faces. They're so young and they're so full of life and they're so full of promise and the future. And as we just heard in that clip, dreams for their lives. and to know what will befall them is crushing. Is the show for you, does it also bring joy?
Oh, absolutely. As moving and as touching and as sad as it is, by the end of the show, it really just reminded me of that generation that was just discovering what it was like to be gay in the 80s, which is, you know, I grew up as a teenager in the 80s, which was a really great decade to grow up in. But there is so much joy. There are rich, wonderfully fun stories being told that I think I really value seeing. As I think we are forgetting gay history in ways that I think is unconscionable, we don't want to forget that there were so many wonderful moments and people and memories from that time.
Mm. Right. And it's not the only show that is tackling this issue. Pose on FX does the same thing. It's set in New York's underground ballroom culture. But why do you think these shows are coming up? Are on now talking about this previous era and talking about AIDS now?
Well, I think Pose specifically is so popular right now because it is a sort of corrective to the stories that weren't being told. I have no memory whatsoever. Again, I watched a lot of television, but I have no memory whatsoever of seeing any black gay characters on television with AIDS. I just don't remember ever seeing that. And so I think Pose is an attempt to say, whoa, let's not forget that it wasn't just white gay men who were dying of AIDS. There were other marginalized populations who were also dying, and we want to tell their stories as well. And I have to think that in much larger picture, I think there is a sense of nostalgia for that era, but I also think that you have generations of gay men, boomers, Gen X, and younger, who don't want to forget those years. I think we live in a time right now when social media, ancient history is what happened last week. And I think that we have gay men who don't want us to forget the people and the stories and the art that was being made at this time. Because if we don't remember that, then I don't think we have much of a future as a gay community, because this is still impacting people to this day. And this was such a devastating time. And we can't let that time and those memories disappear.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for sharing your memories and your perspective on this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Eric Piepenberg. He's writing in the New York Times about what television taught him about HIV/AIDS. The show It's a Sin streams on HBO Max. Coming up, we'll check back in with an Italian opera singer we met a year ago. His nightly arias from his balcony went viral as Italy was in lockdown. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a year ago, at the beginning of the pandemic, fear of the unknown gripped the world. Travel was shut down. Lockdowns and quarantines were implemented with what looked like no end in sight. But amid all that darkness and uncertainty, a hopeful voice soared over the rooftops in Florence, Italy.
My mio mistero è chiuso in me.
During his country's lockdown, Italian tenor Maurizio Marchini went viral for belting out Puccini's Nessun Dorma from his balcony after his wife posted it on Facebook. When we talked to the couple last year, just a few days before our own stay-at-home order here in California, they told us Maurizio became quite in demand after that.
Tutte le sere hanno
every night he has much more public outside. They are waiting for him. So now it's like an appointment. So he has to go out and sing at 6 p.m.
A new kind of theater.
Well, a year later, let's check back in with them. Maurizio and Chiara, welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, ciao.
Hi, ciao. Okay, well, your first lockdown lasted 70 days, so more than 2 months. It was a very long and arduous time. A lot of people died. It was a really dark time in Italy. Your country reopened, but now, a year later, you're back in lockdown. How does that feel?
Sì, nessuno si sarebbe mai aspettato.
So, well, yes, after a year we would have never imagined to find ourselves in the same situation, in a lockdown. In Tuscany, in Florence, right now we are in an orange zone. So the schools are not closed, for example, and we can go out wearing a mask. We can have a coffee and espresso in a bar, but yes, we cannot drink it inside the bar. We have to drink it outside on the road. So it's a bit different from last year.
How is your son handling this? How did he handle the last year?
Beh, anche lui come noi.
So he's reacting to the situation. Last year it was somehow useful because finally he could understand Maurizio's job, because when he saw Maurizio singing on the balcony every night, he finally understood what his job was about.
So you were singing on that balcony a year ago. How long did you keep that up? And are you thinking of going back to it now that you're back in lockdown?
L'altra volta ho cantato per...
So last year he lasted about a week. Then he decided to stop for the many deaths that we saw in Italy. It was very impressive. And also one of his colleagues and a friend died too. So he preferred to stop. And no, he's not thinking to go back again on the balcony and sing. He doesn't feel like it's the right moment.
Mm-hmm. So how has the last year been for you as a performer? You just spoke of the death of your friend, and I'm very sorry for that, for your loss. As a singer, a lot of your performances have been canceled, but then you were so famous for singing from your balcony. What happened professionally for you in the last year?
Sì, ho capito piano piano quello che avevo
fatto. So he said that he didn't expect all of this success and to move all of these people. So yeah, many concerts were cancelled during this year, but he had some unexpected concerts. For example, he did some online concerts for an Irish hospital, and also he sang the national anthem of Italy during the Grand Prix, you know, in Monza, the Formula Uno.
In September.
Formula One, uh-huh.
So there was there were some unexpected events that were very beautiful.
So I don't know if you can sum up this last year and what you, how it's transformed you or how it's changed your thinking about your life as a singer, Italy.
È molto difficile non fare il proprio lavoro in pieno per un anno.
So it's been very hard not to do my job, which is singing, for an entire year. And sometimes I don't have the will to do it again, but I'm also sure that when we gradually go back to our normal lives, I will have the will again. And I would like to sing in front of a real public, not only online.
I think we would all love that. We'd love to see you sing in person.
Yes. Invite me in America.
And I want to play your new song as we're going out. And maybe you could set this up for us. You've recorded a new song. And I know I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but it's Nei Tuoi Colori.
Yes, nice. Nei Tuoi Colori.
Yes, the title Nei Tuoi Colori is In Your Colors, and it was written by Gianmarco Colsi, his agent and manager, and it was a song inspired by the singing on the balcony, and it is dedicated to all of the Italian resilient people.
Hmm. All right, let's hear a little bit of that, Nei Tuoi Colori.
A te che hai fatto grande il canto, bandiera del Rinascimento. Anima mia, acqua di sale, tienici sul tuo seno.
Tenor Maurizio Marchini, his wife Chiara Bagnoli, thank you so much for joining us again on Press Play.
Ciao, thank you, grazie.
Corre il sangue degli eroi, stretti per l'eternità, senza più distanza noi.
All right, that does it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you for listening. I will see you tomorrow.
Porta via.